May it please the court.
Wait a minute, Mr. Salovey, let your compatriot get down back there and get settled.
Oh, excuse me. I apologize. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Salovey, representing the appellant, Robert Powell. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Powell presents his constructive amendment claim. To start with analysis of the constructive amendment claim, it's important to note that his claim relies on an express provision of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution that specifies that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless presentment of indictment of a grand jury. Now, it's not only Mr. Powell's rights that are at stake in this case, Your Honors. It's also the rights of the citizens of the United States of America. It's the right of the people who make up grand juries to set the parameters of what an offense is, to define an offense. And it's also
isn't the offense defined by the statute?
It's defined by the statute, but the United States Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, expressly gives grand jurors a
sure
role.
But what we're asking the grand jury to do is to say whether we should hold somebody over because there's reason to believe that they have violated the statute. So does the statute contain to require the specification of a date?
Your Honor, as to counts 1 and 2, implicitly it does because
I think you can answer my question directly, counsel. Does the statute require the specification of a date?
The language of the statute.
Well, that's all we can do is go to the language of the statute. Which statute are we talking about, and what does it say?
The statutes do not specifically, but as to...
The indictment did, but the statute doesn't.
Correct.
Okay. So was the government obligated to prove a particular date or to have a specific finding about a date?
Well, first
looks
of
like you got the benefit of that with respect to count 4.
Yeah. As to counts 1 and 2... I think the answer is yes, because it in the statute, you have to be, the victims have to be minors. So dates do specifically matter.
The age would be important, wouldn't it?
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. So I think Congress, in that case, actually does state that dates matter, because mm-hmm. for the offense
okay.
to occur...
Do you have any dates here that would render somebody not a minor at the time that something was committed against them?
To dates that you mean as to the facts of this case?
Right.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So that's not really I appreciate the nuance. I think it's a very good point, but it's not really a problem in your case.
Well,
it's not the basis for your appeal.
I think, Your Honor, that we have to look back to the United States Supreme Court decision in Cerrone versus the United States.
I guess before we get too much into that, I guess I'm wondering why it is I have to listen to this argument. Counsel got up, said, I have no objection to the court's failure to give any of my requested instructions. Why does that not waive this argument? I mean, whenever I did that, I didn't think I'd be in here arguing about that in the future.
Sure.
I thought it was over. Right. I waived it.
Right. I think if this court carefully reviews its decision in United States versus Solis,
I did.
It's clear that a waiver did not occur.
Just a minute. In this case, the counsel gave the instructions that he wanted. It had dates in them. The other counsel gave instructions they wanted. Had no dates in them. The court gave those without dates. Counsel, well knowing what happened, gets up and says, oh, I like these instructions. No problem, Judge.
I think right after...
He didn't object. He didn't say no. He didn't say, please, Judge, don't do this to me.
I think looking at the big picture and not specifically whether he made a specific objection, I think we have to look at who's at fault here. How did this problem occur? How did this error occur?
This error occurred because counsel is not responsible to object to the instructions he doesn't want given. The court is somehow responsible when counsel is supposed to be suggesting what he wants and doesn't do it?
The I believe that basically the government also has obligations, Your Honor.
Government gave its instructions, and your client got his instructions, and the court chose some instructions. Having been the district court, it kind of makes me aggravated when somebody comes up above me and now says I give bad instructions when they don't even object. Sure. So you're getting some of those questions.
Sure, I certainly understand, Your Honor. And I also want to try to present that there is a full story here. But if you
get beyond the question of waiver or forfeiture, then you really have to argue this under plain error. I mean, that's sort of the best you can get, right? I mean, if you hadn't said anything at all, you'd be here under plain error. Judge Smith's point is, at best it's forfeiture, at worst it's waiver. But even if we interpreted this record in your favor, you're here on plain error at best. So why is it plain error for the district court to have failed to include dates in instructions to juries that it's not required by statute as an element of the crime?
First of all, in terms of plain error, going back to what is the standard that should apply, I don't believe it's been fully resolved by this court, but we had, in the past, this court has held that when you've had constructive amendments, it was per se reversible. But then you had the Olano case that came out en banc, and matters had to be reconsidered. The Ninth Circuit addressed it somewhat in Jingles, but I believe that was in dicta, and that case was, I believe, resolved on the rule of the case doctrine and not expressly addressing the issue. But I think in addressing constructive amendment claims, the reason I started out with the language of the Fifth Amendment is, and the United States Supreme Court's in Cerrone, that these are serious errors.
How is it a constructive amendment if the evidence matches the allegation?
In this case, the evidence did not match the allegations. It went well beyond. And in terms of
this, what evidence was presented against your client outside the time frame specified in the indictment?
Yes. Your Honor, my reply brief went through that evidence in great detail, but the government presented extensive evidence of Mr. Paul's communications with BM, those are her initials, communications while Mr. Paul was at the Federal Detention Center. And the government made a number of specifically argued to the jury. It said, ladies and gentlemen, you'll hear these calls and you'll hear the defendant's ability to manipulate B. And there will also be additional evidence of his sex trafficking of her. And in opening argument, the government asserted.
But I understand that. But what I don't understand is the evidence of the elements of the offense. Those were all established within the time frame in the indictment, weren't they? Wasn't it?
I think that's difficult to determine, Your Honor, because the jury.
Well, don't you have to show that to argue constructive amendment?
Well, the jury actually came out with an acquittal verdict on count four. Count four concerned June 2014, which comes right into the middle of count three, January 2014 to January 2015. So the jury made a determination, a ruling on acquittal, saying he's not guilty. And those two counts are almost identical. They're different statutes, but they're virtually identical. So the jury speaks loud in this case. The jury made a determination.
Well, if the jury spoke so loudly, then I have a tough time wondering why there was any confusion in their mind as to count one through three, because they specifically ask a question about count four.
Well, I think we're trying to ask the jury to do something that the trial judge and defense counsel on both sides did not pick up.
Well, the problem is, if you're going to use the jury and what the jury did on one side, it's a little tough not to see that they weren't confused as to count one and three when the only place they asked the question was on count four. And count ones through three, they weren't confused. And they came back with a verdict.
I think that's speculation, Your Honor.
Well, I know, but that's why, because you want to speculate as to what they did on count four and how it relates here, but you don't want me to speculate in my questioning to you.
Right. But I believe that this also goes to jury unanimity as well. And you have a broad time period. You have a little over 1 year. You had a defense counsel.
Are you talking about count three now?
Count three, yes.
In count three, as I understand it, it was limited to January 2014 to January 2015, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you conceded, or your client did, that this was a continuing offense, correct?
Correct.
And as I understand it, now I'm just trying to get this through the evidence, the defendant contacted BM in January, February of 2014, after seeing her ad on the back page and asking her to come to work. She went to Las Vegas in February 2014. On the first day, he slapped her and he took her to the street to solicit. She went back to Seattle. She returned to Las Vegas in April 2014 and worked through August. And from Thanksgiving until January 2015, she worked again. So it seems to me there's no evidence except during the dates of January 2014 to January 2015.
Well, there's a 61-day and 86-day period in which they were apart. But
that's during that time period. I mean, I'm just trying to say I looked at the evidence because I thought you might have a point. But what we were really looking at is January 2014 to January 2015. I looked at all the evidence to put in there as to how she could be convicted. And basically, I haven't got anything. The first contact is in January, February of 2014, seeing the ad on the back page. Clear to going back to January, going back from Thanksgiving to January of 2015, she works again. That's the time period. You concede it's a continuing offense, and I'm still trying to figure out why there's any other evidence which convict her outside that time period.
Well, because the government argued extensively that Mr. Powell continued beyond those dates. And this is an outlying case. This is a real outlier.
Well, he called her.
Correct. And the government specifically argued that it went right up through October of 2015. This is our government's argument to the jury. And this case is quite unusual in the sense that I have found no case, I don't believe the government cited a case, in which jury instructions contained no dates and time frames. And the appellant respectfully asserts that dates and time frames do matter and that we still have to look at United States versus Cecil because the original questions look to the statute. I believe counsel looking to Lakin and Harrison Philpott, but Lakin and Harrison Philpott were distinguishable on different levels. In one case, I believe in Lakin, there was a grand jury indictment that listed all sorts of overt acts that made it very clear about the timing. Also, in terms of Harrison Philpott, the defendant made a concession about joining the conspiracy around the date of the offense. So there was no question. This is a highly unique case where there's no dates or time frames. And also, it was extensively litigated in terms of jury unanimity. It's not just a matter of, is there a constructive amendment? It's a matter of jury unanimity. And how does the court know? How does the court know what time frame,
if you have an offense that's alleged to be a continuing offense, starting on or about, you know, January of 2014 and continuing on or about January of 2015, what is it that you want the jury to do when it gets back there? Do they have to agree as to what happened on November 1st and March 15th and July 4th?
Well, first of all, the government never presented a jury instruction to the defining what a continuing defense is. We could talk about the legal niceties.
Okay, so is that set out as a separate issue in your brief? Is that a failure by the district court?
I believe that was presented.
Is this plain error?
I I believe it's plain error.
Did you present a definition?
As to
continuing offense?
I argued that first of all, I believe the Ninth Circuit has not established that these are continuing offenses, although defense counsel made that concession below. That's what I asserted on appeal. And I also asserted that there was extensive evidence where the jury could have found that it was not a continuing offense because of the times they were apart, the times that BM initiated contact with Mr. Paul, the times that she went to work with other pimps, so there was ample grounds to show that, and most importantly, the acquittal verdict on count four, which was in the middle of that time period. So that would cut it off, and it's really the jury saying this is not a continuous offense because both offenses are virtually identical. I'll leave a little time for rebuttal. Thank you,
Your Honor. You really don't have any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivy, I will allow you time for a rebuttal. Ms. Miller?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. On the waiver point, counsel has relied on a decision of this court called United States against Solis. That case is pre-Alano and pre this court's en banc decision in Perez, talking about what you need to do to forfeit versus waive a jury instruction. We think based on both Alano and Perez, there was waiver of the jury instruction issue here. But under any standard, there was no constructive amendment in this case because the evidence of the defendant's guilt was confined to the period charged in the indictment. And also, in closing argument, the government on page 1578 said, I'm now going to describe count three to you, and on page 1579 said, the count begins in January 2015 and ends in January 2015. Now, counsel comes back and says, but in opening argument, the government characterized the communications while Mr. Powell was in the federal penitentiary as additional evidence of sex trafficking. But if you look at that evidence and the way it was characterized in closing, it was additional evidence that he had sex trafficked her, not that he was continuing to do so. And in particular, the government focused on evidence that in November of 2014, he forced BM to strip naked and did a body cavity search on her because he was missing a debit card. And they had a back and forth exchange when he was in prison where he said he felt really bad about that and he thought that that was a despicable thing for him to have done. And the government said that's evidence of his guilty knowledge of sex trafficking. That's evidence that he's guilty of count three as charged during the relevant period. I also think that this isn't... there isn't a unanimity problem here because it's a continuing offense, as this court's question suggests. I'd be happy to address either the Rule 412 or Rule 403 evidence if the court has questions about them.
Well, just on the unanimity, I mean, I think it's an interesting question, just from at least from a metaphysical standpoint, if not from anything else. But so, what does the jury have to agree on? That something occurred during this time? Do they have to agree that specific instances occurred?
Well, the Supreme Court and this court has been clear that you don't have to agree on alternative means. A jury doesn't have to. And so for a continuing offense, they have to agree that during the relevant period charged, he committed the offense. And I think United States against Miller makes clear that evidence that, you know, the jury could have found a couple of different things where the way he violated the statute doesn't mean that there wasn't unanimity.
But if we knew, it's odd. If a March incident, for example, were in question and half the jury said, well, I think he did the thing in March, and half of them said, I don't think he did, but they flipped as to an incident in October with the other half thinking he did. Does that satisfy the unanimity requirement?
I think it does under this court's precedents and the Supreme Court's precedents. I also think that the evidence, the only cases that suggest that might be a problem are when there really is a gap in the evidence. If you look at one of the cases that counsel relies on, there was evidence, there was a drug conspiracy, and there was evidence of a drug sale in December and in June. And the jury asked a question, what do we do if we think there were two separate conspiracies? And so when there's some sort of evidence of genuine confusion on the part of the jury about the elements of the offense, then you might have a unanimity problem. But here there's no such evidence. There's no unanimity problem. All of the evidence is during the period charged. And our theory was this was an offense that began when he started to recruit her and he slapped her. So then you have the elements of, you know, recruiting or harboring. There's a whole list of things you can do, alternative means, and the forced fraud or coercion element. And it continued because every time they were apart, the record shows that within a couple of days, they were in touch again and he was recruiting her again.
I would like for you to address, if you would, the admission of the 2008 conviction.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Under 404B and Rule 403.
If you look at the papers submitted to the district court about the submission of the assault conviction, what counsel for the defense said was, this is not similar, not this is overly prejudicial. In the reply brief on appeal, counsel says this was a pivotal moment in the case because this is why the jury thought he was a bad guy. That's just not consistent with the record. They heard extensive evidence from BM that he was violent. They also heard from an expert witness about pimps and prostitutes, about the nature of the violence in a pimp's relationship. So the idea that this was a source of prejudice or sort of the only reason.
You didn't have anything here that involved a tire iron, did you?
No. We did not, Your Honor, but we did have evidence of violence. He slapped her, he kicked her in the legs, and again, we had an expert witness talking about the fact that pimps are violent, and that's well, four different places.
The testimony on this was so graphic, you know, the bloody towels and the broken skull and all of that stuff. How did that have anything to do with this case, and why isn't it prejudicial?
Well, Your Honor,
unduly prejudicial.
Again, when you're looking at the abuse of discretion standard of review, and you look at what defense said to the district court about why it should be kept out, what the defense said to the district court about why it should be kept out was, it's not similar, not it's so prejudicial. So the district court wasn't asked to rule on that question and didn't really focus on it. And then when it came in, the defense had a standing objection to its submission, but didn't say, this is really prejudicial.
Do you think the government has some responsibility there? I mean, to me, that seems to be
I would agree that it would have been a better practice
problem.
To limit it in some way, but I don't think he can show that it was a harmful error because of all the other evidence that he was violent.
Is that your best argument, that it was error, but harmless error, given the overwhelming evidence?
No, because I don't think it was an abuse of discretion given what the district court was asked before trial and what his ruling was, but I also think that if it was error or if it was an abuse of discretion, it wasn't harmful because there was additional evidence. Also because it was 10 pages of testimony in a 16 or 1700 page record, the suggestion that this was the reason he was convicted, it's just not convincing. It's just not borne out by the evidence given all the other evidence of his violence.
Well, that's your harmless error argument.
Yeah, okay. That's right, Your Honor. But it's harmless error plus an abuse of discretion standard, so that's why I'm couching my answer the way I am.
So you're saying you agree the violent nature of the crime is dissimilar, except that now it was done in the context of a prostitution operation, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And I will also note that there was evidence that we sought to submit to the trial judge before trial that BM and one of the two juveniles was aware of this assault conviction and the facts of it, and the court didn't allow us to submit to present that evidence to the jury because the court thought that would be too prejudicial.
And it was in the context of this prostitution operation and probably showed that Powell was willing to use violence in the operation.
That's right, Your Honor. And it also was similar in the sense that it was a hotel room and they were using the internet to solicit dates. And so there were similarity factors, and those were the factors that were focused on when we asked to be able to present it and the court made the ruling. If the court has no further questions, we ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Nothing.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Miller. Mr. Sullivan?
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the Rule 404B issue, one issue of prejudices is that Judge Jones did not follow his own omnibus order. Required a cautionary instruction before each witness was supposed to testify about these acts, and that never took place. And also in order, in the final instructions, it was also supposed to be a provision about modus operandi, and that wasn't in the final instructions as well.
Was there any objection? A motion?
There was not an objection, but this was very heavily litigated beforehand originally. But as it was transpiring during the trial, neither the government nor defense counsel caught that. And overall, in terms of looking at error, both as to certainly the jury unanimity issue was clearly raised and litigated. But in terms of the constructive amendment issue, I think it's important to look at the fact that both parties have responsibility before the district court to raise issues. And this is a case, not a case where the appellate court is going at it blind because an issue was not raised. Because when the jury did raise the issue about timing and dates, all parties agreed, including the government agreed that time and dates matter. And they said that they looked at the instructions, specifically, I believe, instruction 24. And yes, indeed, we see the problem. And yes, indeed, it should be changed. And Judge Jones made a specific finding that dates and times matter. And he specifically said it didn't matter because you don't know what the jury will really come out and make a decision for. So from an appellate court perspective, in terms of why do we have a requirement for counsel to object, who's at fault? I think it's important to look at the whole picture. The responsibilities of both parties, when a party presents jury instructions, they're supposed to flag issues. They're supposed to say, we're doing something highly unusual in this case, like not including dates and timeframes. And therefore, here's our legal authority, or here's our Ninth Circuit model instruction that we're following. None of that was followed in this case, Your Honor. So I believe it's important to look at in terms of the whole picture and the obligation of both parties to get it right before the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank counsel for the argument. United States versus Powell is submitted. We've concluded the oral argument for the day, and we stand adjourned.